Oh, we have a nice group here today. I was a little worried about Memorial Day weekend. Everybody would have went to the mountains or went to visit relatives or something like that. But glad to have you all here, the Ecclesia community. Wanted to welcome all our guests and everyone that's here. You know, God is such a merciful God. And he shows that through many examples in the Bible. Today I want to show you how God was so merciful to Joshua. And even when he messed up and made a bad decision, God was still very merciful to him. Let's turn, if you will. We're going to go mainly in the book of Joshua today. Let's start out here in chapter 1. Kind of a good premise to start with. We'll read the first couple of verses here in chapter 1. And it says here, "Now after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke unto Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you, and all this people unto the land which I do give to them, even to the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given unto you, as I said unto Moses, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, even unto the great river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and unto the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your coast. There shall not any man be able to stand before you all the days of your life, as I was with Moses. And I will be with you. I will not fail you, nor forsake you. Be strong and of a good courage, and unto this people shall you divide for an inheritance the land which I swore unto your fathers to give them. Only be you strong and very courageous." So we can see that God is emphasizing this over again, "that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper in whatever you or wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth, but you shall meditate therein day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then you shall make your way prosperous, and then you shall have good success. Have not I commanded you? Be strong and of a good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." Well, ancient Israel left Egypt in about 1447 B.C., and with 40 years of wandering, it puts us at 1407 B.C., as the time frame when they entered into the promised land. Now, many look at ancient Israel and what they did as being vengeful and harsh, and God was very harsh in this in coming to the promised land. But God did it for a reason. We'll get into some of those points of this as we get into this sermon. There's quite a contrast that we'll see today in comparison to what we see in today's government of America. We've had multiple apologetic tours, apologizing for what happened during various wars, and frankly, it is a disgrace. God nowhere asked Joshua to apologize for what he instructs him to do, and we'll see this here today as we go through this. Now, the first success that Joshua had was, of course, the Battle of Jericho. That happened, great success. I can imagine Joshua and all of Israel were on a high. Wow, look at how God intervened. The walls fell down. We were able to capture that city. Now, with this mentality in mind, Israel is going on to the next city. And that next city is the city of Ai, spelled A-I. It was a rather small town, about 15 miles from Jericho. And so I can imagine Israel was on their way to conquer this. And after the great battle win at Jericho, Israel was sure that they would win the battle of Ai. But 36 men were killed, and the army of Israel fled, ran away from the city of Ai. We'll pick up this account in Joshua 7, if you will follow along with me here. And we'll start in verse 4 of Joshua 7. You can imagine the mentality of Israel. Great success had happened in Jericho. And now, here we have at Ai, 36 of their men were killed. And so there went out up there of the people about 3,000 men, and they fled before the men of Ai. They're running away from them. And the men of Ai smote of them about 36 men, and they chased them from before the gate, even unto Shebarim, and smote them in the going down, wherefore the hearts of the people melted and became as water. You can only imagine what the countenance was, where they went to. What happened? What occurred? What is different? What about the promises we've just read here in Joshua 1, those first 9 verses? Joshua was perplexed as to why Israel had lost this battle. He was very upset and confused. And notice here his reaction. We'll see here in Joshua 7, verse 6. It's recorded here, and I'm sure Joshua, if he could redo this, would like to. But we see here, and Joshua rent his clothes, fell to the earth upon his face before the ark of the Lord, the ark of the covenant, obviously, until the eventime. Spent a lot of time there before God. Why did this happen? Why did this occur? And he says, he and the elders of Israel did this and put dust on their heads, humbling themselves. And Joshua said, "Alas, O Lord, wherefore hast thou at all brought this people over to Jordan to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us?" We had success in Jericho, and now here we are defeated by the army of the city of Ai, the Amorites. And he makes a statement. You can probably hear the tone of it in what some of Israel said as they were heading towards the promised land. "Would to God we had been content and dwelt on the other side of Jordan." Pretty perplexed with this whole situation, isn't he? So Joshua's attitude, nonetheless, was bad, a lot like ancient Israel. We'll go on here to verse 8. "O Lord, what shall I say when Israel turns their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land shall hear of it." You know, it seems to be that word traveled very fast throughout Canaan when anything occurred. When they crossed the Red Sea, Jericho already knew of it, what had occurred. So these stories travel very fast. "So, for the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land shall hear of it and shall surround us, around us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do unto your great name, God?" A little harsh to God, isn't he, here? So God steps in and says unto Joshua, "Get up. Wherefore, why do you lie upon your face? Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them. For they have even taken of the accursed thing," something that was a pagan idol or statue or artifact, something that God did not like, and have stolen and lied also about it. And they have put it even among their own stuff. Therefore, the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies. This was the reason why. But turned their backs before their enemies because they were accursed. Not in favor of God, but God was cursing them for what had occurred. Neither will I be with you any more, except you destroy the accursed from among you. So the process of finding out who had this accursed thing began. And these words should have been in the forefront of Joshua's mind. We'll look here at Joshua 6 and verse 18. We'll jump here for a while, because God did give a command as to what they should do with the things that they found in these cities. Joshua 6 and verse 18. And you, in any wise, keep yourselves from the accursed things. Those things, those pagan idols, anything that represented that, that went against God. Lest you make yourself accursed. And when you take up the accursed thing and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver, the gold, the vessels of brass and iron are consecrated unto the Lord. They're not yours. They're not for you to have at this time. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord. So God is emphasizing to Joshua that Israel needed to purify themselves and find out what made God turn against them. Something within the camp is wrong, is there that shouldn't be there. We'll go now to Joshua 7 and start out at verse 13, where we ended up on verse 12, where we previously read. So here's Joshua taking action. Up, sanctify the people, and say, sanctify yourselves against tomorrow, for thus says the Lord of God of Israel, there is an accursed thing in the midst of you, O Israel, you cannot stand before your enemies until you take away the accursed thing from among you. In the morning, therefore, here's what we're going to do. In the morning, you shall be brought according to your tribes. Tribe after tribe was brought before Joshua. And it shall be that the tribe which the Lord takes shall come according to the families thereof, and the family which the Lord shall take shall come by household. So what we're reading here is by the Urim and the Thummim, or it could have been by God's answer in front of the Ark of the Covenant. Either one could have given an answer. God is going to select the tribe that has this accursed thing. Then he is going to come and select out of that tribe the household that is guilty of this. And the household which the Lord shall take shall come man by man. God is going to narrow it down to who it is. So, as we read here, we see that this process could have been done through the Urim and the Thummim. And we know that the example is given in Exodus 28. We'll read just a verse or two here. Exodus 28 and verse 30. So God had created this so that answers could be given when there was not one seen. And we read here in verse 30 of Exodus 28, and thou shalt put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be on Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. And Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel upon his heart and before the Lord continually. So what I can determine from the scriptures is the Urim and the Thummim would light up on a particular tribe or stone, describing who it was they were looking for, and show the answer as to what tribe had the accursed thing. This was placed on Aaron's chest and held in place by his vest. So by this Urim and Thummim, the guilty tribe was determined, and finally the name of the person who had brought this accursed thing into the camp of Israel. Achan was found to be the person. Achan narrowed it right down to him. We don't find in the scripture that as this process starts that Achan raises his hand and says, it's me. You don't need to go any further. It's me. Doesn't say anything. But after they had identified Achan, Achan admitted to his guilt of taking spoil from Jericho. But in all of this, he didn't repent. Because of his disobedience, Achan, his family, his livestock were stoned, burned, and then a heap of stones was placed over them as a memorial of his disobedience. There's quite a difference here, what we're going to see between Joshua's attitude and Achan. If Achan had been repentant and showed remorse for his disobedience, a different outcome could have occurred. He could have been spared. In chapter 8 of Joshua, we now see Israel able to return to Ai for a battle that they would now win. News of the fall of Jericho and Ai spread throughout Canaan. And this brings us now, we're going to chapter 9 of Joshua. So great success had come to them through Ai once this accursed thing was taken out of their camp, once this was removed. Let's go on in this story of Joshua. In chapter 9, verse 1, and it came to pass when all the kings which were on this side of the Jordan, in the hills of the valleys, in all the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, Jebusite, heard this story of what had happened to Ai and what had happened to Jericho, and that they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua and with Israel with one accord. And when the inhabitants of Gibeon, here's an interesting story. The inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done unto Jericho and Ai. They did work craftily. They want to do something that will spare their lives. And they went and made as if they had been ambassadors. That means people that were outside of Canaan. And took old sacks upon their asses and wine bottles, old and rent and bound up. And we know that if we look on the map, and you can probably see this in your maps in the back of your Bible, the city of Gibeon was located in the central part of the hill country about 8 miles northwest of Jerusalem. It was the final resting place of Moses' tabernacle. We'll continue on in verse 5. And old shoes and clouted upon their feet, old garments upon them, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. So they're trying to make a case there from way outside of Canaan, and it traveled here because they had heard the stories of what God had done and how he had helped them to win their battles. They did all that they could to give the impression that they had been traveling a great distance, even though they were from this town of Gibeon, very close to where Israel was camped. So the impression was to say that they were from an outside area of Canaan. We'll continue on here in verse 6 in Joshua 9. And they went to Joshua unto the camp of Gilgal, which is southwest of Gibeon, and said unto him and to the men of Israel, we be come from a far country. Now therefore, make you a league or a treaty with us. This is how they wanted to be protected and preserved. They had somehow learned that Israel had been prohibited from making any treaties with the people who lived in the land of Canaan. And we'll see this in Deuteronomy 7 and verse 1. Notice what Moses writes down here in Deuteronomy 7 and verse 1. This is how they are supposed to handle all the people that are in Canaan. Deuteronomy 7 and verse 1. And when the Lord your God shall bring you into the land, whether you go to possess it, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than even you are. And when the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, what are you to do? You are to smite them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. I'm sure that we can think about this today as we see many bumper stickers that say we should coexist and bring all of these foreign religions into our country. Well, it isn't what God wanted Israel to do in their circumstance. Moses and Joshua knew that if a treaty or covenant was made with any of the people of Canaan, that it would cause Israel to not follow God. It would just erode away the belief that God had given them. It would lead to having a relationship with those other cities, those that were within Canaan. And with that, it would lead eventually to marrying within them and giving up their true belief that God had given to them. I was thinking about this as I was studying this. Sometimes we think about, well, they shouldn't have done that because we don't want interracial marriage. No, the point was, it wasn't about interracial marriage. It was because they would marry someone who did not share the same beliefs as they had. The whole point that God is making through this. We'll go on to verse 3 here of Daniel 7. Neither shall you make marriages with them. Their daughters, your daughter shall not, you shall not give unto his son, nor his daughter shall you take unto your son. For they will turn away your son from following me. Here's the whole point of it. It wasn't about race. If the point was they will turn away your son from following me, that they may serve other gods, so will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy you suddenly. But thus shall you deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their images, cut down their groves, burn their graven images with fire. We'll go back to Joshua 9. We'll continue on here in verse 7. And the men of Israel said unto the Hivites, the peradventure you dwell amongst us, how shall we make a treaty with you, the people of Gibeon in that area? And they said unto Joshua, we are your servants. We'll be your servants. And this was the situation that would happen to people that were outside of Canaan. And Joshua, thinking that they were this, said unto them, who are you, and from whence do you come? They also seemed to be aware of God's instruction regarding the treatment of Israel's enemies who did not live in the land of Canaan. The people outside of Canaan were to be treated differently from those that were in the promised land. Notice the differences here. Deuteronomy 20 and verse 10. Look, there is a difference. The people in the promised land were to be treated differently than those that were outside. Deuteronomy 20 and verse 10. And when you come nigh unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make you answer of peace and open unto you, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be, it says tributaries in my my King James, but it means servants unto you, and they shall serve you. So this is what was to happen to the people outside of Canaan. They were to become servants of Israel. We'll drop down here to verse 15. Thus shall you do unto all the cities which are very far off from you, which are not the cities of these nations, but of the cities of these people which the Lord your God does give unto you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes. But thou shalt utterly destroy them, those who are within Canaan, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Let's continue on here in Joshua 9 and verse 9. Joshua 9 and verse 9. So we see the instruction that Moses had given to, or God had given to Moses, and also that Joshua was aware of. The difference between the people who were in Canaan and the people were outside of it. Joshua 9 and verse 9. And they said unto him, from a very far country, the Gibeonites are saying this, your servants are become because of the name of the Lord your God. For we have heard of your fame, the stories, Jericho, Ai, wherever they had gone, crossing the Red Sea, and all that he did in Egypt, coming out of there, being released, and all that he did to the kings of the Amorites that were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, which was at Ashtaroth. So like Rahab, the Gibeonites believed all the reports about God, the God of Israel, and they now sought to make an agreement with his people so they could be spared from certain death. Now, there's some problems that are going to occur because of this. Now, we'll read a little bit further and see what happens. Verse 11, wherefore, our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, and we find that the people of Gibeon didn't have a king. They had like a council of people that made decisions. Take victuals or food with you for the journey, and go to meet them and say to them, we are your servants. Therefore, now make you a league or a treaty with us. This is our bread we took hot for our provision out of our houses on the day we came forth to go unto you. But now, behold, it is dry and moldy. And these bottles of wine which were filled were new, and behold, they are empty now. And these garments and our shoes are become old by reason of the very long journey, really emphasizing this story that is a lie. And the men took of their victuals and asked, not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. So verse 14 is basically Joshua and his men are making a decision without God's input. No Urim and Thummim here, not coming before the Ark of the Covenant, not asking for God's counsel on this. If Joshua had asked God about these people, he would have told them who they were. I'm sure that would have occurred. This was a major mistake on Joshua's part. I think of all the times I've read about Joshua, I've never come up with something where Joshua made a mistake. But here we have a very serious mistake. Let's go on to verse 15. And Joshua made peace with them, didn't go to God and ask who they were, and made a league or a treaty with them to let them live. And the princes of the congregation swore unto them, approved it, said, we will agree with it. And it came to pass at the end of 3 days, not much time had gone by, and interestingly enough, something came to Israel that showed them the mistake they had made. And it came to pass at the end of 3 days, after they had made a treaty or a league with them, that they heard that they were their neighbors, people of Gibeon, and that they dwelt among them in close proximity to them. They were someone from outside of Canaan. This had to have been a jaw-dropping moment for Joshua to have found this out after the treaty had been made. The promise, the vow had been made. How did Joshua deal with this? How did he deal with this? We go on to verse 17. And the children of Israel journeyed and came unto their cities. He's going to approach these people of the Gibeon area on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon, Shephira, Beeroth, and Kirjath Jearim. And the children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation had sworn, taken an oath unto them by the Lord God of Israel. And all the congregation murmured or grumbled against the princes, those that had made this decision to sign this treaty. Yeah, if we didn't, you can just about realize what their mindset was. Well, if we'd have been doing this, we wouldn't have made this stupid decision. but it's written here for a purpose and for a reason. These grumblings were because Israel did not want to go through another situation like what happened with a wrongdoing at Ai. They thought, something's going to happen now with these people of Gibeon because we have made a treaty with them. But all the princes said unto all the congregation, we have sworn unto them. We've made a vow. We've made a treaty by the Lord God of Israel. Now, therefore, we may not touch them. At least they came to their senses to see, yes, they had made this wrong decision. Now here's what we can't do. We can't destroy them. So they had made a treaty where they were the servants of Israel. The leaders of Israel had made a treaty with the Gibeonites, and they could not break their promise. They could not kill them. They could not take revenge because of this lie. This we will do to them. We will even let them live, lest wrath be upon us. Israel didn't want this to happen because of the oath which we have sworn with them. And the princes said unto them, let them live. Excuse me. Let them live, but let them be hewers of wood and drawers of water unto all the congregation, as the princes had promised. And Joshua called for them, and he spoke unto them, saying, wherefore have you deceived us, saying, we are very far from you when you dwell in a close proximity around us. Now, therefore, you are cursed. There is some, punishment here that's going to happen. And there shall none of you be freed from being bondmen. They are going to be servants. Yes, they are going to live. And hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. And they answered Joshua and said, because it was certainly told of your servants how that the Lord your God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you. We didn't want to be included in this. We didn't want to be destroyed. We're trying to figure out some way to make this happen where we won't be destroyed. Therefore, we were sore afraid of our lives because of you and have done this thing. And now behold, we are in your hand, as it seems good and right unto you to do unto us. Do. Better to be a bondman, a servant, than killed. So this was the choice that they made. And so did he unto them, and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel, that they slew them not. And Joshua made them that day the hewers of wood, drawers of water for the congregation, and for the altar of the Lord, even unto this day in the place which he should choose. So God did not punish Israel, interestingly enough here, did not punish Israel for making this decision with the Gibeonites, because they were deceived into thinking that these people were from outside of Canaan. And if they truly were from outside of Canaan, then this was a correct decision now on Joshua's part. What truly was important about making treaties in this situation? Joshua knew this, and I'm sure that was brought to mind the example in Numbers 30 and verse 1. And here's what God says in Numbers 30 and verse 1. And Moses spoke unto the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, this is a thing which the Lord has commanded. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, and this is what they had did with this treaty, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, exactly what they had done, he shall not break his word. Joshua can't go back on his word. All of Israel can't go back on their word now. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth, all that he said. We've made a treaty with you. You are going to be our servants, our bondsmen, to help us help Israel. For Joshua, his word was his bond. His word would be tested once more because of Gibeon, the Gibeonites. Let's look here at Joshua 10. Interesting story as this goes on. We find in Joshua 10 and verse 1, "Now it came to pass when Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, had heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and her king, so he had done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them." Something quite different, isn't it? I'd wondered why they did not go and conquer Jerusalem, because this king was there and they hadn't conquered Jerusalem yet. It hadn't been conquered. And also another fact was Joshua was from the tribe of Ephraim, so his focus was to go where the tribe of Ephraim was settled. And so we have the situation of the Ark of the Covenant ending up in Shiloh. And so that answers a question I've wondered about for years. But we'll go on to verse 3. "Wherefore, Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, sent unto several of these other kings, unto the Hoham, king of Hebron, unto Piram, king of Jarmuth, unto Japhia, king of Lachish, and unto Deber, king of Eglon, saying, oh, come on to me. Help me. There's something not right here. We need to go smite Gibeon. We need to take care of this. They have done this deceitfully. For they have made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel. We're going to take care of this. We're going to get rid of the Gibeonites. Now, Gibeon was looked at by the non-Israelite people as defecting their area in Canaan. Defected. Now gone with Israel. These other southern cities wanted to make an example of the Gibeonites by putting together an alliance to destroy Gibeon. They're going to take care of this. They wanted to deter any other cities from following Israel. The king of Jerusalem sent for the kings of four other cities in about a 30-mile range around there. So we'll pick up this story here. They're going to try to destroy the city of Gibeon. "Therefore the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together and went up, and they and all their host, and encamped before Gibeon and made war against it." They're ready to destroy them, to wipe them off of that area of Canaan, to make an example of someone who would do this, to join with Israel. "And the men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua to the camp of Gilgal, saying, slack not, or hurry up, get over here. We are your servants. We need your protection. Come up to us quickly, save us and help us. We're loyal to you, and because of that, you need to protect us. Help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us." Gathered against us. Would Joshua continue to keep his word? Now that they were bondmen to him, he needed to protect them. So part of this treaty was that Israel would protect Gibeon from being assaulted or attacked by war. We'll continue on here in verse 7. I think we were in Joshua 10, yes. So Joshua responded quickly. He ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. Now this trek to go there from Gilgal to Gibeon was about 20 miles. And what was so bad about it is it's an uphill grade. We'll see here. "And the Lord said unto Joshua," I'm sure Joshua had asked him, "what should we do here?" And God tells him, "The Lord said unto Joshua, fear them not, for I have delivered them into your hand, and there shall not a man of them stand before you. So now Joshua is on his way to take care of this situation with God behind him, God's help and instruction. And in verse 9, Joshua therefore came unto them suddenly and went up from Gilgal all night. All night long they made this trek to defend Gibeon. Not only did Israel travel 20 miles, but had to go up an incline to Gibeon that was about 3,300 feet in altitude. And the Lord threw them, that means all of these armies that are going to attack Gibeon, threw them into a panic before Israel. You know, God had used this technique many times where the defending armies were just panic struck, didn't know what to do. And so Israel slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon and chased them along the way that goes up to Beth Horon and smote them to Azekah and unto Makeda. God honored his promise and delivered the Amorites into the hands of Israel by creating a contagious fear among them. And it came to pass as they fled from before Israel. You can imagine Israel is probably pretty tired, been traveling through the night. And if it wasn't bad enough, an uphill climb to get to Gibeon. So as it came to pass as they fled before Israel and were in the going down to Beth Horon. So going up to Gibeon, then going down to Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down great stones, hailstones from heaven, giving some added help here from heaven unto them, unto Azekah, and they died. They were more which died with the hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with the sword. God's promise to protect the Beth Horon ascent was a location of the pass controlled by Gibeon, which led to the valley of Ajalon and westward to the coast. A very instrumental area there. This event was a type of seventh bowl plague. I think you can see here many people killed with these hailstones, kind of like Revelation 16 and verse 21 when we get into the bowl plagues. So back here to Joshua 10, we'll continue on in verse 12. Then spoke Joshua to the Lord. There must have been some of them left that were alive. You can imagine how exhausted Joshua is. This is quite a battle, but God is saying, or the Lord has said, we are going to deliver you, you are going to win, and I'm going to help. And spoke Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. Notice the boldness and what Joshua is going to say. And he said in the sight of Israel, we need some help to accomplish this. Sun, stand you still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. Quite a remarkable request, isn't it? For this to happen, so they could complete the task of winning the battle. And the sun stood still, God responded and honored his request, and the moon stayed. You know, here is Joshua and the men of Israel had, yes, made an agreement with Gibeon. Yes, it shouldn't have happened. But now that it has happened, God is making the best of the situation and helping Joshua and the men of Israel to win this battle. So the sun stood still, the moon stayed until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Jasher, a non-inspired book? You could probably go and find that and see some more of the story. So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hastened not to go down about a whole day, quite a lengthy period of time for daylight to continue on. I looked some of this up in some historical accounts, and some think that this time frame of the extension of the day was 23 hours and 20 minutes approximately. Many countries have made the same comment about this in looking up information about Joshua's long day. the Chinese, people of Mexico, and various countries around the world have all commented about a day that was considerably longer than normal during this time. We'll continue on to verse 14 here as we'll start to conclude. And there was no day like that before it or after it, that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man, Joshua, for the Lord fought for Israel. God's mercy was upon Joshua and Israel as they fought against the kings who were against Gibeon and Israel. God was very merciful. This miracle was a reminder that God was giving Israel the land of Canaan as it had promised. This was the third miracle that was recorded in Joshua's life. We had the stopping of the Jordan River that happened, and the destruction of Jericho, and now we see the sun and moon remained in their position for an extended period of time. God was very merciful to Joshua. I'd like to turn to the last chapter of Joshua here, see if I can pick this up. Joshua's reached a very old age. He's 110 years old, and he's giving this comment unto the people that are going to take over from him. Let's read through some of this. I'm going to start in Joshua 24. Let's start in verse 14. Joshua is trying to encourage them to follow God. Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. You know, Joshua did do that. And put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve you the Lord. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Would they choose something different than following the Lord after all of the circumstances that had happened? And the people answered and said, God forbid that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For the Lord our God, he it is that brought us up and our fathers out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, and which did those great signs in our sight and preserved us in all the way wherein we went up, and among all the people through whom we passed. And I'm sure this story passed on to the areas around them to tell them what the great God had done for Israel. I'm going to jump forward here to verse 29. Actually, I'll back up to 28 here. So Joshua let the people depart, every man unto his inheritance. And it came to pass after these things that Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Serah, which is in Mount Ephraim, in that area that was part of his tribe, on the north side of the hill of Gaash. And Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua. Yes, he was a strong leader. But look at the effect that Joshua had upon these people. And not only just during Joshua days, but all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, and which had known all the works of the Lord that he had done for Israel. So, God was very merciful through the decision that Joshua had made, an incorrect one, to take on the Gibeonites, to make a treaty with them. But God was so merciful that when Joshua did what was right, that he was able to help the Gibeonites and to help Israel to continue on to be a success. It is a very merciful God that we have, and that treated Joshua in such a manner.